From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Washington Watch as we continue our special coverage this week's second annual Ministerial to Advance Religious Freedom being held at the U.S. Department of State here in Washington, D.C. Coming up, the British government via the Foreign Secretary commissioned an independent study of the persecution of Christians around the world. The report, which was just finalized last week, was conducted by the Bishop of Truro, Philip Montstephen. He joins us later here on Washington Watch. Also, even though we are focused on this international gathering of leaders, which is emphasizing the advancement of religious freedom, there are other issues of significance taking place this week. An unprecedented showdown on the House floor yesterday as Democrats claimed the president's statements challenging members of Congress for attacking America were racist. Also, the administration's new Title 10 ruling, which prohibits abortion facilities from receiving federal family planning funds, has been upheld by the Ninth Circuit, meaning it's now in effect. What does that mean for Planned Parenthood? We'll talk about it in just a moment. House Minority Whip Steve Scalise, Louisiana congressman, represents the 1st District, will join us in just a few minutes from the House floor. And Travis Weber, Vice President of Policy and Government Affairs, will be joining me in the program as we discuss the highlights from today's ministerial gathering here at the State Department. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it's at T. Perkins. All right. The Ninth Circuit Court ruled 7-4 that the Trump administration's regulations governing Title 10 family planning funds can go into effect. Now, this program, the issue goes all the way back to Ronald Reagan, who had what was called a co-location rule. We've talked about this before on the program, meaning that Title 10 funds, which is for family planning, could not go to organizations or institutions that were doing abortions or referring for abortions within the same facility. Planned Parenthood obviously fighting that rule. Well, they lost in court. What does it mean to Planned Parenthood? Well, it means about $60 million. Joining me now to talk about it is my good friend, the Minority Whip on the in the House of Representatives, Congressman Steve Scalise. Steve, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Tony, always great to be back with you. How about this great news?
Well, this is very encouraging when you see that you had an administration backed by members of Congress, not all, but you had a large segment. You certainly had unification on the Republican side backing the administration and changing these rules. It shows what the administration can accomplish even on their own when they're willing to lead.
It really is one more reason why it's so important that you've got a strong pro-life president in the White House. And think about this, Tony. How often do we get to talk about a victory in the Ninth Circuit of all places? You know, fortunately, many times now we talk about victories at the Supreme Court level, and no small part to the two great new members that Donald Trump has put on the Supreme Court. But even in the Ninth Circuit, that tells you how important this was, how well put together the president's new ruling was.
Well, Steve, you actually bring up another good issue. I mean, this speaks to a couple of issues of this administration. The president actually has nominated, and the Senate has confirmed new members to the Ninth Circuit, which has caused a shift there. So this is the president following through on his pledge to put pro-life constitutionalists onto the courts, and then not just talk about pro-life policies, but actually pursue them. That's, that says a lot.
Oh, it really does. He's done phenomenal things in terms of standing up for life, not just on who he's put on the federal bench, but, you know, some of these new rules that he's put in place, like the restrictions on Title X funding. And it's been something that, you know, I get to work with the president on a lot of things, but he's, I think, going to be talking more about these issues, especially when you look at the Born Alive Act that we're trying to pass. The president really wants that bill on his desk. And you talk about a bill that shows the difference between real conservative values that this country's founded upon versus the radical extreme left, not even Democrat views, but far radical socialist views where they think a baby can be murdered after it's born alive and call that abortion. And I think you're going to see the president ratchet up that kind of talk, why it's so important that we have success in next year's election.
Well, Congressman Scalise, let's talk about that. measure for just a moment, the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act. You and your colleague from Missouri have the measure there calling for a discharge petition that would mandate, require Nancy Pelosi to let this go forward and have a vote on it.
Yeah, Tony. Ann Wagner from Missouri took the lead in filing the bill to the Born Alive Act to make sure that if a baby's born alive outside the womb and has full protections under law, and you've seen in New York they allow that baby to be murdered, a number of other states, the Virginia governor talked about how they can actually do it. And people, I think, were disgusted across the nation when they heard about this and the fact that in many states it's not, the baby's not protected. And so that's why Ann Wagner filed the bill. Pelosi won't bring it to the floor, but I filed a discharge petition. We're at 200 signatures now. We only need 18 more. We have three Democrats, but we need a lot more. And this is where people can get involved in calling their member of Congress. And if they're not already on the petition, tell them how important it is. If you really do believe in protecting life, you have to sign that petition to bring that bill to the floor for a vote.
And by the way, folks, if you've not yet joined our campaign to end birthday abortions, you can do that by going to the website, TonyPerkins.com. Working with Congressman Scalise, we're going to deliver 90,000 of those newborn thermal baby hats to Nancy Pelosi to send a very clear message that the Americans want infanticide prohibited in this country, that we will not tolerate that. Of course, we're going to continue to work to build a culture that embraces the sanctity of human life, all life, regardless of what zip code it may be conceived in or what side of the tracks it may be born on. We see it as worthy of being protected by our laws. Congressman Scalise,
Tony, thank you for leading that charge, by the way, and promoting that, the campaign that you're on to just raise awareness and raise money to help protect these babies. It's to be applauded, and I appreciate your leadership.
Well, we're just coming in. It's a partnership. You guys are leading on the Hill. We want to help do that because we think this is a very significant moment for America. And I think the president recognizes this. This is why he spoke so clearly to it in his State of the Union address, and he continues to talk about it. America is at a point, as Ronald Reagan said, a moment of choosing. And I think if we go down the path that the Democratic Party wants to take us from a policy standpoint, it is, as you said, infanticide. It is the murder of babies that are born, or you have a choice of protecting the unborn. So I think, quite frankly, Steve, you know, you and I have been in politics for about 25 years. I don't think the contrast between the ideology of the two parties has ever been sharper in its contrast.
No, it's so true. And, you know, I don't think we would have come to a point in the days of real blue dog Democrats where, you know, you'd have Republicans and Democrats working together to support life. Even things like the Hyde Amendment that are sacrosanct to ensure that taxpayer funds aren't used for abortion. Even that's under attack now because of these far left socialist Democrats who have taken over the House with Nancy Pelosi and are pushing that kind of radical agenda. And people look at it and go, wait a minute, this is not middle America. These aren't the values our country was founded upon, and yet they're under attack. And I think people are watching. People all across the country are watching. They're disgusted by. They're shocked. I know I've heard so many people going, wait a minute, why do you even need a law to protect those babies? That's murder.
Right.
Actually, in many of those states, it's not considered murder. We need a law to protect those babies, and that's why we're pushing to get this done.
Well, speaking of that, Congressman Scalise, by the way, folks, you're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, your host. Congressman Steve Scalise of Louisiana, Minority Whip, my guest. We're broadcasting live. You hear a little noise in the background. Live from the U.S. Department of State here in Washington for the second annual ministerial. But checking in on Capitol Hill, a lot going on there. Steve, I want to transition to you know, the president. We've talked about what the stands that he's taken. You talked about those that have hijacked or taken over the Democratic Party with a very radical socialist agenda that in many, are attacking America, and the president pushing back on them. I got a clip from Nancy Pelosi accusing the president of saying things that are racist. I want to play that clip.
These comments from the White House are disgraceful and disgusting. And the comments are racist. Every single member of this institution, Democratic and Republican, should join us in condemning the president's racist tweets.
What do you say to Nancy Pelosi, Steve?
Well, she ought to apologize for saying that. In fact, she broke the House rules when she said that yesterday. And none other than Steny Hoyer, the Democrat majority leader, who admonished her from the speaker's rostrum and said that when she said that, she was in violation of House rules. And she wouldn't back away from it because they're just so scared of the far radical left. And, you know, in the AOC group, the squad that are out there scaring other Democrats into, you know, if you don't vote with the radical socialist agenda, then they'll primary them in their Democrat primary. And so you've got these Democrats in swing districts that are running around voting for socialist policy against the wishes of their own constituents because they're afraid of AOC. And keep in mind, AOC just a week ago called Nancy Pelosi a racist, Tony. That's how crazy this has gotten. And by the way, where's the resolution that Nancy Pelosi brought forward to admonish AOC for actually calling her a racist? This is how ridiculous it is.
Yeah, you know, Steve, last time I checked, the Statue of Liberty said, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be free, not your antagonistic squads breathing hatred for America." And I think the president was just pushing back, defending America. And,
this president has done so much, and you know this, but look at how much President Trump has done to help minorities. With the tax cut bill, he made sure, right. He worked extra hard to make sure the tax cuts affected the low-income people the most, and it has, and in fact, it's helping to rebuild the middle class. And the numbers back it up. I mean, we have the lowest unemployment amongst African-Americans and Hispanics in the history of our country. And when the president touted that as a success, he's happy to see that people of all races and colors and gender are succeeding. And yet all the Democrats, almost every Democrat, sat down on their hands at the
right.
State of the Union when the president touted that. They weren't celebrating that success.
Right.
Women-owned businesses, by the way, Tony, are up over 20% over the last few years because of this booming economy. And so it's helping, you know, the rising tide rises all ships. It's actually helping lower-income people, minorities, even more than every other income group. And they're not celebrating that success. They keep attacking the president. Right now, on the floor, by the way, I'm getting ready to go to vote. If you watch C-SPAN, there is a vote right now on the House floor on impeaching the president of the United States. Al Green, a liberal Democrat, brought literally articles of impeachment just now that we're voting on the House floor. This is how ridiculous it's gotten, where their hatred of the president and their, frankly, it's a lack of respect for the country having an election. We had a duly elected president of the United States, and look, we've been in elections where we've won and where we've lost. And when you lose, you know, you respect the outcome and you go and work to try to change the outcome in the next election, which
right.
is next year. You don't go and try to every day harass and attack the president and impeach the president, yet that's what they're doing.
It's a dangerous time for America and requiring all Americans to be aware, to be vigilant, to be engaged. Congressman Steve Scalise, as always, great to have you on the program. Go to the House floor and vote.
Always great to be with you, Tony. Appreciate it.
All right. Congressman Steve Scalise, Minority Whip from Louisiana. I mean, these are challenging times. And you see, the reason the president gets so much pushback is because of the good things that he's doing. I mean, he is moving America forward, all of America. All right, don't go away. When we come back, the United Kingdom doing an in-depth report globally on the persecution of Christians. We talk about it next here on Washington Watch. Don't go away.
Can United States senators interrogate court nominees on their religious beliefs? This is a controversial question that our country is facing today. In light of this controversy, FRC has taken up the task of answering this question with one of their latest publications, Rebels Without a Clause. We've seen in recent Senate confirmation hearings a troubling pattern arise where senators have begun questioning presidential nominees about their faith as an attempt to discredit them. These interrogations have gone so far as to asking nominees of their theological beliefs, church membership, and associations with faith-based nonprofits. It has been an alarming display of hostility toward religion and people of faith. Visit frc.org/test to learn what questioning the Constitution's No Religious Test Clause allows and forbids in the process of confirming judicial nominees. That's frc.org/test.
The latest Trojan horse on Capitol Hill is called the Equality Act. The way the left is advertising this bill is misleading because it does not further equality at all. It would actually violate current protections in place that allow private institutions and people of faith to freely act in accordance to their deeply held beliefs. The Equality Act explicitly removes religious liberty protections that were originally put in place with bipartisan support. Its stated goal is equality, but its actual result is harm to vast members of communities, individuals, and Americans as a whole by undercutting our foundational freedom of religion. Is this really what equality looks like? A more fitting name for the Equality Act would be the Inequality Act. For more information on the mass threat of the Equality Act, visit frc.org/EqualityAct2019. That's frc.org/EqualityAct2019.
Many advances made by the homosexual movement are based on the claim that sexual orientation is immutable or unchangeable. This belief was a deciding factor in the 2015 Supreme Court case that redefined marriage to include same-sex couples. It has been a key argument for LGB activists fighting to restrict or ban therapies for people seeking help to overcome their same-sex attraction. But is sexual orientation written in stone? Should we brand people with an immovable sexual orientation label and tell them, you can't change, don't try to change, even if they want to? In a new publication from FRC, we reveal that sexual orientation can change. Survey data shows that heterosexuality is largely stable, but homosexuality is not. Even pro-LGB scholars are calling for the immutability argument to be abandoned. The question is, why is the LGB movement pushing this false argument? To learn more, visit frc.org/sexualorientation. That's frc.org/sexualorientation.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So glad to have you with us as we continue our coverage here at the Ministerial to Advance Religious Freedom. With over 1,000 representatives from about 130 countries for this week. This is the second time. Last year was the first. And I want to address in this segment a report from the United Kingdom on the persecution of Christians. Now, this preliminary report came out a couple of months ago, right after the USURF report came out. But what is quite fascinating about this report and enlightening is that they found that the overwhelming majority, estimated at 80% of the persecuted religious individuals around the world, are Christians. And they said Christianity is at risk of disappearing in some parts of the world, and anti-Christian persecution is increasing in severity. Joining me now is the Right Reverend Philip Montstephen, a British Anglican bishop and missionary. He has been the Bishop of Truro since November 2018. Beforehand, he served as executive leader of the Church of the Mission Society and worked for the Church Pastoral Aid Society, and was asked to do this independent report by the Foreign Secretary of the UK. Bishop, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Thank you for being here in the United States at this ministerial. I'm just going to jump right into this. One of the aspects of this report that has gathered gained so much attention, in fact, when I was briefing the Vice President on the USURF report, he commented on your report, the fact that you estimate 80% of the persecuted believers around the world, the faithful, are Christians.
I know, and it is a shocking figure. That figure comes from the International Society for Human Rights. You won't actually find it on their website anymore, and we did dig into that with them. It was a figure from about 10 years ago, but we talked to them. And they said that they were confident in that figure. They want to launch fresh research into it. But not only were they confident about that figure, but they reckon that that is a conservative estimate of the situation now. And I think you know, I don't want for one minute to ignore the way that members of other faiths are persecuted. And there's some appalling things happening. I mean, what's happening to the Uyghur Muslims in China is absolutely outrageous. But I think that the fact is that the Christian faith today is the one true global faith, and this is a global phenomenon that we're facing. So in that sense, it's not surprising that Christians are more in the firing line than any other faith. One of the things we say in the report, this is a single global phenomenon, but it has multiple drivers in multiply different places. So it's not surprising, as I say, that a truly global faith like the Christian faith should be significantly more on the firing line than any other.
Now, you were quoted as saying political correctness has a reason. Political correctness is a reason that people are afraid to stand up for religious liberty. Quote, the sense of misguided political correctness that has stopped us standing up for the Christians overseas must end.
That was actually the words of the British Foreign Secretary, but I don't disagree with them. I think there, certainly in the British mindset, I think there are lots of things going on. I think there's because, you know, we have this long historic Christian tradition, but in many ways, you know, large parts of society have moved away from it. I think there's an embarrassment about the Christian faith. I think there's a failure to recognize that the Christian faith is predominantly a global faith and a predominant phenomenon of the global south and therefore of the global poor. I think there's a great sense of post-colonial guilt around as well that I think has influenced the Foreign Office, and a kind of mentality that says, well, we interfered uninvited in these places in the past and we shouldn't do so now. So there's a lot of I think there is a political correctness thing as well that says, well, you know, who are we to tell anyone else what to do? And the net effect of that, I think, is that we've turned a blind eye when we really shouldn't have done, and we've failed to live up to our moral responsibilities in the whole area.
Well, Bishop, if that continues, does that not probably fuel even greater religious persecution? Because if you see one of the world's largest denominations, which also happens to be one of the largest persecuted denominations or faiths, if they are abandoned, where's going to be the motivation to reach other faith groups that are being persecuted?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And the recommendations that we formulated for the Foreign and Commonwealth Office are, you know, very clear that we think the British government, and I would say this to all governments, need to stand up for the freedom of religion or belief for everybody.
Right.
This is, you know, this is foundational. This is what Article 18 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is all about. There are various reasons why we've said that. One of the reasons is a very pragmatic reason, that if you are seen in some parts of the world to favour the Christian community over others, you actually make that community more vulnerable. And that's a real risk, and
right,
something we really need to avoid. I think, you know, I'd also want to say it's absolutely not part of the Christian tradition for us to seek special favors for ourselves.
Right.
So, you know, our duty is to love our neighbor as ourselves, whoever that neighbor may be.
I was going to ask you about that, because that's also part of the Christian faith, is to accept persecution, rejection, to operate in meekness. So it's not necessarily to push back. And I'm wondering if that's a part of this.
I think, you know, I absolutely accept. I think it is part of our Christian discipleship to reckon that we may well face opposition. But equally, I don't think that's a recipe for us to be kind of to sit on the sidelines when we see our brothers and sisters being.
No, I absolutely agree with that. I think from the perspective of us in the United States, Britain, we should speak up for
Absolutely.
Those, because we have a voice, we have the ability to shape policy. Bishop, we're up against a break.
Yeah,
I want to
sure.
ask you if you'll stick around for just a moment.
Yeah,
and
glad to.
We want to continue this conversation. A very enlightening and troubling report out of the UK on the persecution of Christians in particular, but people of all faiths around the world. All right, folks, don't go away. We're going to come back with more from the second annual Ministerial to Advance Religious Freedom here at the State Department in Washington, D.C. We'll be back with more on the other side of this break. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
In states like New York, Virginia, and Vermont, radical legislation has been written legalizing abortion late in pregnancy, when babies can feel pain and are able to live outside the womb.
Happy birthday to you.
They've gone even further, repealing protections of infants born alive, allowing killing even after birth.
Happy birthday to you.
Congress has yet to protect the life of every newborn baby. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com to send Nancy Pelosi a newborn hat to show Congress every new life should be welcomed with warmth and love, not hate, not death. End birthday abortions. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com.
Happy birthday to you.
Paid for by Family Research Council.
There is unprecedented religious persecution around the globe. In recent years, research has found increasing governmental and social hostility towards religious believers worldwide. For the last 10 years, Christians have been harassed in more countries, including the United States, than any other religious group. While the specific threats to religious freedom vary in type and intensity, one common source is the legal and cultural support for apostasy, blasphemy, and anti-conversion laws, which often threaten the freedom to choose or change one's faith. In a new publication from Family Research Council, we list which nations around the world have these unjust laws on the books and spotlight people who have faced severe penalties simply for sharing or changing their faith. For more information on religious hostility due to apostasy, blasphemy, and anti-conversion laws around the world, visit frc.org/ABA laws. That's frc.org/ABA laws.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So glad to have you with us on this Wednesday afternoon as we continue our coverage of the second annual Ministerial to Advance Religious Freedom, hosted here at the U.S. Department of State in Washington, D.C. Continuing my conversation with the Bishop of Truro, Philip Montstephen. Bishop, thanks for sticking around again.
My pleasure.
Excellent work in this report. We were discussing some of the reasons that the Christian faith occupy 80% of the persecuted around the world. We're talking about, number one, Christians don't necessarily push back, which doesn't absolve us in other places where we have our freedoms to advocate for them.
Sure.
But there's certain to be some additional underlying reasons for
this. Yeah, absolutely. I think this was one of the things that was really something of an eye-opener to me. You know, if you just kind of pan back historically, and when I was a student at university, I belonged to the Eastern European Prayer Group, and we prayed for persecuted Christians behind the Iron Curtain. It was a, you know, wasn't a uniform picture, but we know that there were a number of people, for instance, particularly in the Soviet Union, who suffered pretty appalling persecution. The Berlin Wall fell, and I think we kind of felt this thing had receded and kind of disappeared. And it seems to me it's just kind of crept up on us over the last few years and grown into something that is global in scope. And I was shocked by the scale, the scope, and the severity of the whole thing. Now, we then need to ask why. What's going on? And I think that there are at least four really serious global factors that we need to take into account. One of them is the rise of religious fundamentalism and bigotry that manifests itself in violence, and that is from a number of religious traditions, certainly not just Islam. Secondly, the rise of authoritarian governments that brook no dissent. Then you've got militant nationalism that again identifies one religious community, one religious tradition as being authentic to that expression of nationalism and therefore pushes hard against others. And you also got to have a phenomenon of kind of criminal activity, gang activity on an industrial scale, often driven by drugs, where you've got weak governments. I mean, it was a real shock to me that the most dangerous place in the world to be a Roman Catholic priest is in Mexico. because you have these gangs who are, you know, subverting society, and the people who stand in the way are the priests and the pastors, and they are literally in the firing line. So, you know, I think there are two reasons why we really, really, really need to care about this issue. One is there's a moral imperative to look after people of faith and, you know, the 80% of Christians who are, you know, I count as my brothers and sisters in Christ around the world. But actually, there's some really important pragmatic political reasons why we should do this as well, because there's some really ugly things going on in the world today. And I think religious persecution is often the, you know, it's the bellwether, it's the canary in the mine. You see that going on.
Right.
There's some, and you think about how this impacts upon other, you know, fundamental human rights. Where religious persecution is happening, you're going to be finding people trafficking, you're going to be finding forced conversion, forced marriage, terrible gender inequality, gender-based violence, denial of freedom of expression, denial of a shed load of other human rights. And I always want to say, I think the right of freedom of religion or belief, as it's enshrined in Article 18, is the foundational human right on which every other one depends.
Absolutely.
You see that violated, you know, you can be pretty certain there's some pretty ugly things going on.
But if you get this one right, you have a greater chance of seeing the other freedoms established.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. I think it is. It is therefore foundational. This is a fundamental right. When it's denied, you see all sorts of other things falling with it. When it's maintained and asserted, you know, I think then you find plural, tolerant societies being developed that are less of a threat to security, and simply make better places to do business. They make better trading partners as well, because they are inherently more stable communities.
We just got a couple minutes left, and I want to get to this. I know this was for the foreign secretary there in the United Kingdom, but it has application elsewhere. What are some of the recommendations? Mm. How do we address this correctly?
Yeah, there are a number of recommendations we made out. So I'm basically been sent to Foreign Commonwealth Office, you know, you need to mainstream in this in your thinking, in your activity. Don't see this as a sidebar issue. See it as central. Become much more religiously literate as an organization. You'll do your job better if you understand how the rest of the world thinks in terms of faith. Don't be afraid to use the levers that you've got, the seat on the UN Security Council, etc. You know, step up to the plate, basically.
And those are some of the same aspects that this administration is looking at here in the United States that has put a greater point on religious freedom. And, you know, I think it's critical. I think what we're seeing, growing body of research shows that if you get this right, you have greater economic development, you have a greater social stability and security. Mm-hmm. And that serves all of mankind well.
Yeah, it does. Absolutely right. Yeah.
Bishop, thanks so much for taking time to join us today.
Been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Very, very enlightening. And folks, you can see a copy. We're going to have a link to this on our website. You know, this type of information is very instructive, and I'm grateful to see, as we were talking about yesterday with the Hungarian government stepping up, the UK. I'm actually hoping that this creates even greater, you know, push for the United States government to continue to focus on this issue as they have. All right. Don't go away. We're coming back with more Washington Watch. We're going to do a wrap on the day. Travis Weber going to be joining me. We're going to be looking at some of the highlights from today's presentations and speeches here at the Family Research, at the Ministerial. Also be talking a little bit about the panels that I was on today discussing the issue as well. Don't go away. More to come.
Did you know that babies survive failed abortions? Sadly, many of these babies are denied their human right to life and are allowed to die. Currently, there is no federal criminal statute in place to protect these babies after they are born alive. Congress and state legislatures across the country have responded by putting forth legislation to protect infants who survive abortion. However, leftist politicians have blocked efforts in Congress and in state legislatures to pass the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, which requires that life-saving medical care be given to babies born alive after failed abortion attempts. We must decide as a country where we stand on the issue of infanticide, to either pursue humane protections for those most vulnerable in our society or continue to subject innocent human life to the whims of abortionists. For more information, visit frc.org/bornalive. Today, military personnel are at greater risk than ever of suffering from a mental health condition. On average, 21 active and retired military members take their own lives every day. Richard Gleaston, a military and veteran advocate in the area of mental health, recently shared evidence that faith-based solutions can help stop this crisis. Here's what Richard had to say.
There's new science out that they watch people while they're praying or have a religious relationship. The frontal part of their brain, if I'm correct in remembering what they told me, it strengthens it. It reduces depression, reduces anxiety and stress while you're doing it. So not only did God give us prayer as a way to alleviate our spirit, it also alleviates our mind and our bodies. Our bodies react in a positive way to a faith-based relationship.
Visit frc.org/speakers to hear more.
Did you know that thanks to President Trump, abortion giant Planned Parenthood can no longer receive up to $60 million in federal funding? This new federal protection for the unborn is thanks to a rule change that the Trump administration implemented to the Title X Family Planning Grant Program, which will take effect in May 2019. Not only do the new Title X rule changes take funding away from our nation's largest abortion supplier, they also ensure that taxpayer dollars are not used for abortion and open the door for pro-life pregnancy resource centers and other faith-based organizations to apply for Title X funds, thus expanding the health care options of needy families who are experiencing unexpected pregnancies. For more information about the new Title X rule changes that protect the unborn and increase health care options, visit frc.org/Title X. That's frc.org/Title X.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, your host. We're broadcasting live from the U.S. Department of State here in Washington, D.C. as we wrap up day two of the second annual Ministerial to Advance Religious Freedom, a gathering of over 1,000 leaders. These are civil society leaders, governmental leaders from close to 130 different countries that have gathered here at the invitation of the Secretary of State to discuss how we advance religious freedom internationally. By the way, if you'd like to find out more, you can go to the website, go to TonyPerkins.com. We've got some links up there, but there's a lot of good information. And I think it's we're going to talk about this in just a moment. Today I was a part of a couple of panels, just the conversation that is taking place among different religious groups, different ethnic groups, different countries, putting an emphasis, a spotlight on religious freedom cannot hurt. It can only help the plight of the persecuted around the globe. Well, join me now to talk more about some of the highlights from today and give us a little, as we go a little deeper in analysis, is Travis Weber, who's Vice President of Policy and Government Affairs here at the Family Research Council, also oversees the Center for Religious Liberty. Travis, welcome back to day two here at the Ministerial.
Thank you, Tony.
All right. I'm going to get, well, let's just start with this. Big takeaways for today. What was, you know, I'm going to go in, I got some clips I want to play here, some sound bites that Connor has pulled up for us. But first, what was big ticket items you saw today?
Yeah, big ticket items today. I think the one theme, if I had to boil it down to one, the role of religion in the public square, as highlighted by the role that faith-based communities play in the building and rebuilding of society. And that's really the way to boil it down in many ways today.
Yeah. And again, I go back. I was just in fact, I had to run across the street from one of the panel sessions that was over at the Institute of Peace, where there was a rabbi, a bishop, an imam, an educator, and Tony Perkins. It almost sounds like, you know, set up for one of those jokes or something. But the reality is, I'm not sure
that the type of conversations that and interaction that's taking place here would happen.
Yeah, I mean, religious freedom brings together everyone who's religious and who wants freedom, right? So religious freedom includes those of different faiths who want to be protected to live out their faith. And I think, you know, for those of us in the United States, we have our own context, our own history of understanding this, which is unique in the world. But for those in other countries, it may feel different. If you're a Christian that makes up a very small minority of a certain country, you're going to perceive the dynamic in your country and how the government protects you and the need for government protection a little bit differently. And what draws us all together, though, is the conceptual idea of religious freedom and the need to see it protected and the need to work towards its protection.
Right. And I want to be very clear here, because I was clear on the panel discussion. That does not mean that we lose our spiritual individual identity, that we somehow I'm not talking about one big happy spiritual, kumbaya moment. I mean, we're very different. We hold different theological views, and we have to maintain those views and teach those views to our children. But as Americans and as citizens of this country and really as occupants of this world, this globe, you know, we can find cultural unity while maintaining our spiritual uniqueness, and that we should never, as Christians, never, you know, try to hide or dial back our faith in Jesus Christ and what gives us hope and purpose and meaning. But at the same time, as we have these conversations and these dialogues with others, you know, it leads to humanizing people, it leads to solving problems together. And again, I only think positive things can come out of this.
Hey, Tony, this is a key point. The key is we maintain our own beliefs theologically while working towards what we can agree on culturally and politically. We can absolutely work. Let's look at the pro-life movement in a different context. We are able to work on an issue with people which we don't agree with. We don't agree with them all theologically, in other contexts, even on religious freedom, to bring it back home to what we're focusing on today. So, crucial point, because we don't want to fall into the trap of saying we must agree with people on everything in order to work with them.
Right.
At the same time, we don't want to say it's not true.
Yeah.
And we don't want to say at the same time that, oh, we can't talk to you if I disagree with you on these things over here. So this is why we're making a point about this.
Well, and I mean, I made the point there were two Baptists on the panel, that last panel. And, you know, even as Baptists, we don't always agree. But we work together for a common good. So I think in the broader context of religious freedom, we can work with people of different faiths without in any way compromising or yielding up our individual beliefs.
Tony, we heard at our own side event on Syria last night from Yazidi activists. We heard from Christians. We heard from those of different faiths. And Yazidi activists, one of whom has been working to help the Yazidi community that's been horribly persecuted by ISIS over the last several years. And it's incredible to hear this person speak about the issues that what they're engaged in from their faith perspective. I'm glad we heard from him. It doesn't mean we agree with him theologically, but here's a person who's engaged in work that we want to see happen and we want to support.
We want all people to have the freedom to choose to believe or not to believe. And by the way, folks, if you missed that excellent gathering we had last night at FRC, which we broadcast on the web, you can still watch it. It was very informative and, just extremely informative as to what's happening in northeast Syria. There's a link at TonyPerkins.com, and you can go watch it. We actually had leaders from northeast Syria that were here speaking from, again, different faith backgrounds, as Travis said. Okay, Travis, I want to get to some of the high points from earlier here from earlier today here at the ministerial. A lot of folks remember Asiya Bibi, the woman who was in prison in Pakistan, charged with blasphemy. I mean, a long ordeal, finally released just a few months ago. Well, there's a backstory that was told here today. Sean Taseer, the son of a governor in Punjab, India, who was assassinated in 2011 for calling
Pakistan to reform their blasphemy laws. There was a fatwa put out for this governor's death, and he was ultimately killed by his own bodyguard in December of 2016. Here's a clip from what his son had to say here today.
So my name is Shan Tasir. My father died defending a poor Christian woman in Pakistan who was accused by the blasphemy law. The world has come to know her as Asia Bibi, and today that woman is free. She's a free woman. She's been exonerated by the highest courts in the country. But I want everyone to know that there are 200 more Asia Bibis in jail in Pakistan today.
There was one of the largest applause lines I've heard so far in the General Assembly of Leaders was when the blasphemy laws were mentioned and a call for those to be changed. What's it going to take for Pakistan? And they're not the only country, but to see these blasphemy laws changed.
Tony, I think that'll take two things: outside and internal political pressure, and secondly, social change and internal social pressure from forces within that society. The reason Pakistan is such a bad and unique situation is that you have a very extreme view within Islam on the question of blasphemy specifically. The Barlevi School of Jurisprudence within Sunni Islam has developed to a point where they're taking this and applying it against non-Muslims when historically it had not been. And thankfully, there are people working to overturn this and change this dynamic. I know Muslims who are working to explore within Islam and convince Muslims within Pakistan that they have the incorrect approach to this. But the point is, this is a long-term process within Pakistan. It's an extreme issue because you have this school of jurisprudence that was subscribed to by one of Salman Taseer's bodyguards who assassinated him. Now, the bodyguard was convicted, executed, and for this crime. But now we heard from the son of this political figure in Pakistan, Salman Taseer, who stood up against blasphemy laws, stood up for religious freedom, highlights the real extreme dynamic in that country. So the Pakistan Supreme Court overturned Asia Bibi's sentence, a good development, but it takes pressure on them to do that and this change at the same time.
Right. And these laws remain not only in Pakistan, but other countries as well. Another story this morning. Il-young Ju is another survivor of persecution who escaped North Korea with his family. His parents listened to illegal South Korean Christian radio for almost 10 years while in North Korea, which inspired them to develop and explore their faith and to find faith in Jesus Christ. Ju relayed the experiences he has heard from escapees of political prisons in North Korea. Here's a clip of what he had to say. Play clip five, please.
The females, they're not provided any medication where they're giving birth, or they are forcefully have to lose their kids, their babies. And also, in terms of food provision, they're only given like a very small portion of corn.
The stories that you hear from survivors in these prisons, religious political prisons, you know, right here we're talking about North Korea, denied medicines, no help with having babies, given only a small portion of corn to eat. Travis, North Korea is still on the top of the list of the 50 worst countries where Christians are persecuted. Our listeners need to, I think, urge President Trump to continue, and I know he is, but I think we got to keep reminding this administration that has so many different priorities that he needs to use his influence with Kim Jong-un to allow Christians to practice their faith without oppressive interference.
Tony, the situation in North Korea is dire. It's extreme in terms of religious freedom problems. It's really going to take change at so many levels. You know, we think about religious freedom there, but these stories of survivors are crucial. When I was in Taiwan several months ago, I met with another survivor from South Korea, and she described a horrific story of being captured, sent back to North Korea, being put through a forced abortion, and she gave a powerful testimony of her own faith in God, carrying her through that, but it was horrific. So we have to applaud and support these survivors, which helps shine the light back onto the oppression, and there's so much darkness. There's spiritual darkness, but there's darkness in terms of being able to see what's going on in North Korea.
Yeah, and I think part of it, Travis, just as we saw 5 years ago, roughly, when we were pushing the Obama administration to recognize the genocide that was taking place in the Middle East with the Yazidis and with the Christians. You know, the problem with that is once there is a recognition of the problem, there comes a responsibility. And I think that's why some are hesitant to focus on this. But as Christians in this country, I think we have to be educated. We have to know what's going on. And we do have to take responsibility. And part of that is praying for these, for the persecuted church, those that are being persecuted around the globe. As we heard earlier from the Bishop of Truro, 80% of the world's persecuted population are Christians.
Tony, absolutely. When it comes to North Korea especially, you know, there are things there that we really need God to intervene and bring unity to the Korean church, North and South Korea. As the bishop, you referenced the bishop's comments. There was so much material today. They talked about, on that panel, which you were also part of, the role that government, government reporting, government tracking of these issues can play. And I found it interesting that the UK had referenced our State Department's reports. There, one of their officers had referenced our report, helping her understand the issues of religious freedom. So the role that government plays in highlighting the issues. Another panel in which you were on discussing USAID's role, working with religious communities, the role of religion in the public square. And there are so many other issues we can get into here, because this really all comes back to recognizing the role of religion in the public square. Without that, you know, all of this is effectively sidelined, as we've seen it sidelined in the past.
Right. And that was a key element of our last panel discussion about how government should recognize the role of the faith community in their call to serve their fellow human being and not try to marginalize and exclude them, which is exactly what we saw domestically in the last administration, Catholic Charities being one of the primary examples of that. It's extremely important that government see religious communities as partners in serving their fellow citizens.
And some of this just goes back to faulty understandings of the Establishment Clause and sort of muddled thinking on this idea that you can't kind of work with religion in the halls of the State Department or in the federal government. The world is, I think that the latest Pew figures had 84% of the world with a religious affiliation, and that's only going to increase when you look at the number,
right,
the population growth. So why would we look at a factor that's integral to 84% of the world's people, integral to their lives, and say we're not going to deal with that?
And that was another important part that came out of the one panel with the Bishop of Truro, talking about educating diplomats in the West of the importance of religion, because in the secular West, the West that has become increasingly secular, United States, that we don't understand that many, many people, in fact, most people around the world are motivated by their faith.
And yet you have, you know, a group like the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a secular think tank, saying this needs to be included in foreign policy.
Travis Weber, that music means you're out of time.
Thanks for having me again, Tim.
All right, Travis, thanks for joining us. Folks, I'm out of time as well. Until next time, I encourage you to check out the website, TonyPerkins.com, and do this, as the Apostle Paul says in Ephesians 6, when you've done everything else, when you've prayed, when you've prepared, and when you've taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.